Can there be color without mass? Who put the bop in the bop shoo wop shoo wop? Why is the sky blue? Every look through the prism provides a new answer. Welcome to the Prism on the Voice of Russia. I'm Andrew Hiller. Today we gaze through the crystal to examine the neurological origin of love and desire, search through echocardiograms to identify features that could lead to sudden death in athletes. But first, we look at a cluster of stars so close to home that we never bothered to take a closer look. You are entering the world of the prism. Sitting less than 1,000 light years from our home of a bright blue marble is a loose group of stars that astronomers have known about for about 180 years, but that for some reason has never attracted great attention. Now, some scientists believe that this cluster may be an important new tool in the quest to understand the evolution of stars, like our own sun, and in the search for planets similar to Earth. Joining us to take a look at this cluster is Jason T. Wright, an assistant professor of astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State University. Welcome, Dr. Wright.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is an interesting week to consider space, especially with the passing of the first female astronaut. Did those early shuttle missions help to inspire you?
I was interested in astronomy as far back as I can remember, but I do have distinct memories of being at school and learning about the Challenger explosion, the investigation of which Sally Ride played an important role in. It definitely helped me be more aware of America's space program.
And investigations of what went wrong and what went right are a huge part of science in any case. In this case, it seems like there was an investigation which was long delayed. Why haven't we been looking at Ruprecht for so long if we've known about it for 180 years?
Well, when it was first discovered in 1830 by John Herschel, he was cataloging all sorts of things in the sky to compile what he called the general catalog, based largely on his father's observations of such things. And he wanted to be sure that he cataloged everything he could see that looked interesting. This particular cluster is so close, it actually appears rather large on the sky, as astronomers think. So you might need binoculars to see it. But it's about 1 degree across on the sky, and it's in a very rich part of the sky in the constellation Sagittarius. When you look toward this cluster, you're looking almost directly at the heart of the galaxy. And this is a part of the sky that's filled with stars, and it's filled with dark clouds, and it's filled with bright stars. And it's actually pretty remarkable that he was able to pick this cluster out, despite the fact that it has only it only has about 40 stars that he would have seen probably to distinguish it from the field in such a rich part of the sky. And because it's such a loose group of stars, astronomers for a long time neglected it. There weren't that many stars. It didn't seem that interesting. And in fact, we have found that a lot of celestial handbooks describing the cluster say that it's probably what we call an asterism, which is just a random collection of stars that aren't physically associated, probably at very different distances.
So they didn't actually believe it was real, and that's why, even though it was relatively close, the sun and stars of its system were relatively approximately the same age as our own, and there were Earth-like planets, we believe, it didn't garner great fascination. What drew you to it?
What drew me to it were a series of papers that came out by a couple of groups, one led by an astronomer named Diaz, another led by an astronomer named Karchenko. They were looking at all of the known clusters in the sky, all the known star clusters, and attempting to characterize them all in a uniform way. And because this cluster had been sort of faithfully copied from catalog of clusters to catalog of clusters, it was still around in the catalogs that they were using, but no one had ever investigated them since it was discovered. And so when they did their analysis of all of the clusters, this one sort of popped out as being potentially quite old and quite close. And what I noticed was that this result had made it into a resource I was using, and I looked into it, and I was actually skeptical when I saw those numbers, because I thought a cluster so old and so close would be a wonderful thing, and it wouldn't have been overlooked for so long if it were really so important. But the more I looked into it, the more I realized that it was old. It really was close. They had the right parameters, and it had just somehow escaped notice for over 175 years.
Now, when you say it has the right parameters, what do you mean by that?
Well, most stars form in clusters. And so when they're young, they tend to be with all of their brothers and sisters, essentially, in these young clusters. So most of the clusters we see are young like this. But as clusters orbit through the galaxy, there's galactic tides, passing giant molecular clouds, and other disturbances slowly tease the cluster apart. And most of them don't make it past a few hundred million years before all of the stars are just going in their own ways throughout the galaxy. But some clusters have enough stars and avoid getting torn apart, whether through chance or just through the orbit they happen to have, and manage to last longer. And so we only have a few old clusters. And because they're so rare, they tend to be far away. We tend to have to look a long ways before we find one. So it's actually pretty surprising that there's an old cluster so close to Earth.
Is it the age of the cluster or its qualities that make you think that this one might be a good baseline to use as a comparison for other celestial observations?
Everything we know about stars, their fundamental properties, well, almost everything we know, comes from two kinds of objects: the sun, which we can study up close, and clusters of stars, which contain lots of stars that are all made of the same stuff and have the same age, but have different masses. And it's based on clusters that we build our stellar models and understand stars that aren't in clusters. So when we study clusters, we're almost always studying young stars. So finding an old cluster is valuable because it lets us apply the techniques we use to understand how stars work to stars as old as the sun. And, for that matter, typical field stars, that is, stars not in clusters, most of those are older as well. So finding a cluster of old stars teaches us more about all the other stars in the galaxy. It's also significant that it's close, which means it's easier to study them. Some of the best clusters that have old stars before this was known were so far away that to study stars like the sun in those clusters, you needed the largest telescopes in the world and a lot of time on them. This one is so much closer that we can study the sun-like stars and the lower mass stars much more easily.
And with this observation that you've begun to do, has it helped to confirm or disprove some of the popular theories or some of the unpopular ones?
This is step one in the investigation, which is proving that it's not an asterism, that it's a real cluster, figuring out exactly how far away it is, and figuring out exactly how old it is. And we've just published our very first paper on the cluster, which is the first paper ever published on this cluster, establishing these things. And for the past few years, we've been teaming up with other astronomers that look into other questions and determining what we're going to do with it and what sorts of questions we're going to answer. Some of the questions I'm most interested in are, how old are other stars that we look at? We can use this cluster as a benchmark and look at how the stars in this cluster appear, and then see whether a given star, maybe one that has a planet around it, does it look older or younger than that cluster? And since we know the age of the cluster, that will help us learn the age of the star by comparison.
And you're also interested in the movements and the orbits of both the stars and the planets within this cluster.
We would love to go look and find the planets in this cluster. In fact, it was just last week that we were discussing how to go about finding the planets orbiting the stars in this cluster. And we started putting together some observing proposals for that already. One surprising aspect of this cluster is that it appears that a surprisingly large fraction of its stars are in binary systems, that is, pairs of stars orbiting each other, and not as many single stars as we thought we would find. And we have some ideas for why that happened, and that's another interesting thing we're learning.
That is interesting. I'll come back to that in a moment, but you hinted a couple times that this is a very close system. You can find it with a pair of binoculars. What kind of tools, though, are you using to examine this? What can you use? What can amateur astronomers use?
So this cluster presents some special problems when trying to study it. Because it's so close, it's a relatively large object on the sky. It would be a few full moons across if you could really make out all of the stars in it with your naked eye. And most telescopes that astronomers use don't have the field of view to see the whole cluster at once. So it's pretty expensive in terms of telescope time to try and study this, because you have to make a mosaic by tiling a lot of images of the cluster together. So we've had to use some specialized instruments that were designed to have particularly wide fields of view.
Hmm.
So we've used the MMT telescope, which has a large, what we call multi-object spectrograph, to study many of the stars at once. And we've taken imaging with the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope on Mauna Kea.
So perhaps one of the reasons that this cluster hasn't been properly examined in the past is because telescopes were farsighted.
I guess that's true, but I think it mostly took noticing it in the catalog, taking a chance and saying, maybe this really is what it appears. But mostly it took those original papers by Diaz and Karchenko that stumbled across it in their survey of all of the clusters in the sky to say, look, this looks old and close. I wonder if that's right.
Why are they these binaries? Why are we having these planets or these double sun combos?
Yeah, we think we know the answer to that, and it has to do with the fact that the lowest mass stars are the ones that tend to leave clusters first as they get teased apart. The heaviest stars tend to sink to the middle of the cluster, and when you have a pair of stars together, what counts is the total mass. And so we think the cluster may have been extremely rich at one point, just filled with stars, and that the only ones left are the very heaviest stars and the pairs of stars, because they basically have twice the mass.
Now,
but that's speculation at this point. We're not sure.
Now, I thought I read that this cluster was reasonably close in age to our home system.
That's right. It's about half the age of the sun, which is pretty close to the age of the sun as clusters go. The sun is about 5 billion years old. Most clusters we study are somewhere between 10 and 100 million years old. So much, much younger than the sun. It's rare to find any clusters that are older than about 1 billion years, clusters of this type. And this one looks like it's 2 to 3 billion years old, which in terms of how stars age, it's middle age. So I guess maybe a good comparison would be to say it's like most stars were toddlers, and you want to know more about 50-year-olds. And this one comes along, and it's 30. Well, 30 is a lot closer to 50 than 3 is.
Now, you began answering this question already, but what are some of the next questions which you would love to delve into?
I would like to know why so many of the stars in this cluster come in pairs and in triples. I'd really like to know how many planets are orbiting the stars in this cluster. Because when we discover planets orbiting other stars, we rarely can tell how old those planets are, unless the star it's orbiting happens to be very young or happens to be in a cluster. So this will give us an opportunity to find planets whose ages we know, and we can see how planetary systems change with time by looking at a snapshot of planetary systems of a known age.
Well, looking at a neighbor that we haven't spent enough time visiting, I'm Andrew Hiller for The Prism. And I've been joined by Dr. Jason Wright, an assistant professor of astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State University. Thank you so much for your time and sharing with us this discovery.
Thanks for having me.
And now, a moment in the culinary prism with Olga Okorakova. Later on in the show, we're going to find out where in the human brain love and desire comes from. But in case someone wants a physical location to help them in that search, what are some places where you might go in the nation's capital?
You know, Andrew, when I'm really in the mood to be in a quiet, relaxed, but yet a nice and romantic environment, I really like Cafe Leopold's in Georgetown.
What makes it a good romantic hotspot?
It's a cute little European restaurant that's tucked away from the loud Georgetown crowd, which, you know, I really prefer because, you know, some of these tourist places, I mean, they're cute, they're romantic, but they're just...
So you mean you don't get a great romantic feeling from the Hard Rock Cafe?
No, I don't. Cafe Leopold in particular, you know, I really like it because once you go in there, you really feel like you're in Europe. It has this very, like, old Europe, Renaissance feel to it. They have these like cobblestone flooring, lots of greenery, put up candles. Then again, if you're really feeling romantic, nothing beats preparing a simple dinner for your date, for your spouse, instead of going out. I think it's more personal and thus creates a more intimate setting. When the weather is nice and the sky is full of stars, nothing beats the romance of a great night outdoors.
Thank you. That was Olga Okorakova in The Culinary Prism. You're listening to The Prism on The Voice of Russia. We'll be right back after this break.